It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine about some of the most interesting stories in the world of science, including changes at a super volcano in Italy and how scientists are trying to interpret those changes.
First, residents of the east side of Madison experienced some extremely unusual weather over the weekend. On Saturday afternoon, a tornado touched down along one of the city's main roads. While some homes and businesses were damaged, there have been no reports of deaths or injuries.
Weather-wise, there's usually a few things we expect in a Wisconsin October: cooler temperatures, some frost here and there maybe, the occasional pre-Halloween snowfall. A tornado? Not so much. But just how uncommon was Saturday's tornado?
Jonathan Erdman joins us now. He's a senior meteorologist at weather.com, and he's based in Waukesha County. Jonathan, welcome back.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, Jonathan, this seemed really strange. From a meteorological perspective, I can say that word. What happened? Why was there a tornado on a seemingly moderate, mild day in October?
Well, strange almost doesn't do it enough justice. Just to put it in perspective, going back in Wisconsin history, the tornadoes that we've been able to document going back to the mid-19th century, only 2% of those have occurred in October. You know, our typical peak times of year are June, followed by July, May, and August. So the fact that it happened in early October was strange enough. And then, frankly, many of the forecasts, including forecasts from NOAA Storm Prediction Center, the National Weather Service, and frankly, at weather.com and the Weather Channel, were not forecasting severe thunderstorms in southern Wisconsin on Saturday, but all it took was just one cell.
The severe weather alert on my phone actually went off. The sirens, as far as I heard, never sounded. It happened very suddenly. How are we doing with the state of prediction for tornadoes?
Well, Veronica, the tricky part about this particular case was that, in general, severe weather was not anticipated in southern Wisconsin. The setup was somewhat marginal to even get thunderstorms to form. And, in fact, the storm that spawned the Madison tornado didn't produce any lightning. So it was technically a shower. So these particular cases like this, unfortunately, on occasion, do go undetected by the National Weather Service, partially because it's a day where you're not expecting those kind of severe thunderstorms, and secondly, because the signatures on radar in this particular case were so subtle, you know, as opposed to a classic supercell in Oklahoma that just has this massive rotation that you see on Doppler radar. The rotation with the Madison tornado was very, very subtle on a day where we weren't expecting severe weather to begin with. So it was a very difficult case to actually catch ahead of time. And, I guess I would say, in general, for the stronger tornadoes, say at EF2s and stronger, this Madison tornado was an EF0, but for the stronger tornadoes, the National Weather Service forecast is basically catch a good 90 to 95% of those. But this one was very subtle and very hard to detect in real time. And as a result, the warning did not occur before the tornado touched down.
You use the term EF0. What does that mean?
Well, it's based on a scale called the Enhanced Fujita Scale, which is an attempt to correlate the damage that a tornado produces to its tornado wind speeds. We can't measure tornado wind speeds directly because Doppler radars are fixed in a certain location and can't be driven right up to a tornado unless they're on a mobile Doppler radar for research. So what meteorologists try to do is they take this Enhanced Fujita scale and they look at the degree of the damage to trees, to buildings, and they try and match it up to what the tornado's wind speeds were. And in the case of the Madison tornado, it was an EF0 with estimated peak winds of 70 to 80 miles per hour. So we get a lot of EF0 tornadoes in the United States every year. They're the large majority of them, thank goodness. And this one was certainly on the weaker side, but of course it did produce quite a bit of damage.
And as you were saying, you know, we think of tornadoes as a summer phenomenon. This was not by any means common, but can tornadoes develop any time if the conditions are right?
You know, they really can. Of course, being as far north as we are here in the state of Wisconsin, we don't obviously see too many tornadoes, say, in November, December, or January for reasons that it's just too cold. There's Arctic air in place. But it's interesting, the last several years, we go back to, for instance, to January of 2008, we actually had an EF3 tornado down in Kenosha County.
Wow.
That because there was just enough warm and humid air, and there was cold air aloft, and there was enough shearing winds or changing winds in direction and speed with height, we did have several tornadoes on a January day in 2008. So it could happen any time of year if the conditions are right.
We're talking to Jonathan Erdman right now, a senior meteorologist at weather.com, talking about this weekend's unusual tornado for October, touchdown on Madison's east side and also in Sun Prairie. And Jonathan, walk us through those conditions again. What does it take to create a tornado? Is it warm air meets cool air?
Yeah, it's a combination of conditions. Typically, you want warm. Let's step back. Let's take the classic Wisconsin tornado day. And if you think of it in terms of it's hot, it's humid. I mean, you walk outside, temperatures are at least in the 80s, maybe 90s. There's a nice south to southwest wind. It just feels like you're walking into a hairdryer. It's that hot, it's humid. And in the upper levels of the atmosphere, then you have a strong jet stream that's punching over that warm and humid air mass. So it's bringing cool and dry air aloft. And so what that is that sets up an unstable atmosphere where you get rising air rather quickly, and you form supercell thunderstorms that then produce tornadoes. So that's the classic Wisconsin tornado day. And if we look back on Saturday, it wasn't in the 90s, obviously. Madison had a high of 76 degrees that day, but it was certainly humid with dew points generally in the low 60s, dew point is a measure of moisture in the air. So when you get into the 60s, it starts to feel humid, and really by October standards, that's pretty humid for southern Wisconsin in October. And you had a nice little jet stream disturbance that was coming across through the upper Midwest and pivoting into that warm and humid air, and it just set off this little north-south band of showers that one of those showers just happened to have spawned the Madison tornado.
It feels like it's been kind of a weird several months weather-wise. The summer seemed pretty wet, wetter than normal, and the fall has seemed warmer than normal, and then we have this tornado. Is there any indication that kind of weirdo tornadoes like this are becoming more common and out of season?
It's a tough call to make on the scale of Wisconsin, but you know, as I did mention earlier, 9 years ago we had a January tornado event that was the only three January tornadoes of record in the state of Wisconsin. That was just 9 years ago, and if we go back 7 years ago, right around Thanksgiving Day of 2010, we had three other tornadoes in Wisconsin. So, in general, the warmer. We can't correlate any individual tornado events with, say, a warming climate because the scales are just too small. A scale of a tornado is, a few city blocks or several miles versus the scale of climate change is, of course, on a global scale and occurring over years and decades. But in general, if we have a warming climate, we would expect the window of severe weather possibility to kind of inch its way toward the other parts of the calendar that you may not normally think of as severe weather days. So maybe a little bit later into the fall, maybe a little bit earlier into the spring. And on these weird occasions, we could get, as we did in 2008, we could get even a January or a November, even a December severe weather event in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So, I think that's something that we can expect, going forward over the next several years in a general warming climate.
And in the extended forecast, any outlook for more turbulent weather like that?
Well, there is some good news, and by good news, we've been kind of in a drought in some parts of Wisconsin, especially the southeastern part of the state, which didn't get the rain that fell last weekend to an extent, say, in southwest and central Wisconsin. So we'll have some more rain and maybe a few thunderstorms going Tuesday into early Wednesday. And then we have another chance of some soaking rain, unfortunately, in time for the weekend. So it's kind of a mixed blessing. I know the farmers want to get their crops harvested, so that's not good news for them. But for those that have parched lawns in the far southeast Wisconsin, that's probably good news there. But for now, it doesn't look like a lot of severe weather, fortunately, is in play. But in general, it looks like we're going to have overall warmer than average weather, at least for the next week or two.
Jonathan, thanks a lot for talking today.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Erdman is a senior meteorologist at weather.com based in Waukesha County, joining us to talk about this weekend's unusual tornado that touched down on Madison's east side.
Right now, there have been changes at the site of a super volcano that overlooks the Italian city of Naples, and scientists can't agree if the signs point toward a catastrophic eruption or not.
Gemma Tarlak is a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, and she's with us once a month to talk about the latest cool science news. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello, friends, on this gorgeous autumn day.
Yes, and not so gorgeous. This super volcano, from, I guess, an awesome perspective, it is that. But Gemma, tell us about what we know about this super volcano in Italy.
Yeah, well, you know, the interesting thing is when you talk about Naples, one of Italy's largest cities, and then you talk about kind of a volcanic threat there, I think almost all of us would think immediately of Mount Vesuvius, which is kind of on the city's edge. But it turns out Mount Vesuvius is second banana to an even bigger threat that a lot of people don't know about. It's called Campi Flegrei, and apologies to any native Italian speakers for mangling that pronunciation. Probably got it wrong. But this is basically a caldera or a super volcano that sits right underneath some of Naples' most densely populated suburbs.
And the landscape of this area, it sounds like in large part, was built when this caldera, this super volcano, blew up, what, hundreds of thousands of years ago?
Well, it's blown up a couple times. It's erupted a few times that we know of. The biggest eruption from it, the most powerful one, was about 40,000 years ago, and it sent 300 cubic kilometers of ash and rock skyward. It impacted global climate. There's some research out that thinks that the way it changed climate may have spelled kind of the death knell for Neanderthals, which went extinct right around that time. So there are all these the terrible things associated with the last enormous eruption, the most powerful one. But it has kind of blown its top a few times since then, not on such a great scale, though.
And Gemma, what makes a supervolcano a supervolcano?
That's a good question, and that's why I'm kind of shying away from using the term supervolcano. The scientists we talked to for this story much prefer the term caldera, and that is because of the kind of volcano it is, but also because there is, believe it or not, there is no scientifically agreed and evidence-backed definition of supervolcano. So the researchers really prefer to call it a caldera. It is one big volcano, okay? However you want to call it, it's a big one.
Now, scientists and people there, and I guess people around the world, should be wondering, well, how do we know if this thing's going to blow up again? What are scientists on site monitoring as they watch this?
Well, they're monitoring so many different things. And you know, that's kind of one of the interesting things about the most recent research, because there were two papers out in the last year, and the scientists who authored the papers used the same data, and they reached different conclusions. And that's because we really, in 2017, we still don't really understand how volcanoes in general, and in particular, the large ones, the calderas, we really don't understand exactly how they work. But they agree on one thing. It's doing something. The volcano is doing something anomalous. And when they're monitoring, they're looking at what kind of gases it's emitting. They're looking at how hot the rock is and how much heat is being transferred from the magma chamber that is underneath the volcano and into the rock. And they're looking for signs. Is the rock weakening? Is it bending? Is it reaching the point where it might not be able to bend anymore as the pressure grows? And they even look at the composition of the gases being emitted, because that can be a clue that the volcano is getting to do something.
What do we know about what could happen if the caldera were to erupt?
It would not be good. I mean, that's kind of the short way to put it. But, you know, a lot of scientists, obviously, because this could affect millions of people, it could affect millions of Neapolitans very immediately and very directly and very catastrophically. And in addition to that, it could also affect things like agriculture, air travel. The entire economy of Europe might be affected. So what they do is they draw up these maps based on previous eruptions and the signs that they left us in terms of damage, as well as things like wind patterns. So the people in Naples would be very much affected by pyroclastic flow for example, and that is a really horrific kind of a super hot rock avalanche. But they would also be affected by ash, and they think that there might be enough ash shot upward in the sky that as it fell, it could pretty much flatten the city, which would, of course, be horrible. And there's so many different ways of looking at this, but let's just say if it does erupt, it would be catastrophic.
Now, this is something, a volcano that's moving in many ways on geologic timescales, and we're, of course, living in human timescales. How accurate can we be of saying if this is going to, is this something that could happen in the next 10 years or the next 1,000 years?
Well, you know, the thing with this particular caldera, and it's true of actually many calderas around the world, it does not have a set eruption pattern. You know, some volcanoes do. You could say, oh, it erupts every 1,000 years or every 100,000 years. But this one, there's no rhyme or reason to its eruption schedule. So because of that, and because the researchers are not exactly sure what the things it's doing right now actually mean, they're not willing to put any kind of guesstimate on when it might erupt, or even if it might erupt. There's actually a school of thought about this volcano that these signs that we're seeing, the changes in the elasticity of rock and the changes in the gas composition, this might actually be a sign that it's going dormant, that it's shutting down. So unfortunately, they're a huge mystery, and we really don't know that much about calderas, but everyone agrees that this particular one is doing something.
Gemma Tarlak is with us right now. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, looking at some cool science news right now. And Gemma, there is an archaeological site off the shore of a lake in an Istanbul suburb that is yielding some fascinating findings. What's the story there?
Yeah, this is neat. And I have to say, this is our inaugural on-site mini column. And we really want to take readers to some of these fascinating archaeological sites where there's work underway, there are really interesting finds, but they might not make the biggest headlines. And this particular site is called Bathnaya, and it is indeed on the outskirts of a lake in Istanbul. And, you know, this researcher 10 years ago said, I think there's got to be something there. And all her colleagues kind of laughed her off, like, no, there's nothing there. Why would there be something there? She started digging, her team started digging, and they have found incredible artifacts. Some of them are almost a million years old. But as they're digging through the layers, they found these prehistoric artifacts, as well as, you know, from the ancient Greek era, from the Byzantine Empire. It's a treasure trove, really. And personally, I think the most interesting find is it's an ancient drugstore. They have found hundreds of these small ceramic and glass bottles all in this one little area, and they analyzed the chemical residue left inside the bottles, and it bears remarkably similar chemical footprints to some of the drugs we use today to treat depression and heart disease.
And when do we date that to?
That is, I believe, from about 2 millennia ago.
And so what's next for this site, Gemma?
They're still digging.
We don't know everything.
Yeah, as long as they find stuff, they're just going to keep digging. And, you know, it's one of those wonderful sites where layer upon layer upon layer of different people, different cultures, different civilizations have been preserved. So they're just going to, you know, keep at it until they can't find anything else.
And then finally, there was a piece on color in this month's edition and things we didn't know about color and some scary stuff about how people historically colored their food and milk. Some yucky stuff got put in there to make it look better.
Yeah, I found this fascinating that back in the day, to hide the fact that they had watered down their dairy so, you know, they can make more money off of it, producers used to tint the milk yellow with lead chromate. Mm. Don't do this at home, folks, okay? Just don't do that. So anyway, so they would tint the milk and it would be yellow to hide the fact that it was watered down. And then when they started actually selling white milk, kind of, you know, pure white goodness, white milk, people refused to buy it because it wasn't yellow, so they assumed it had been colored white and that there was something wrong with the milk.
Wow. Well, there's also some stuff that I have seen in my own marriage, men and women reacting differently to color, seeing color differently.
Yeah, you know, and in particular, the gene mutation that makes people with XY chromosomes red-green colorblind, so they have a a lot of difficulty seeing colors as most of the population sees them. That same genetic mutation in people with double X chromosomes, it actually, they think it might be enhanced color vision. It might be something called tetrachromacy, which means instead of, like most humans, you see red, green, and blue, you actually see a fourth color. Now, don't ask me what that color is, because there are so few people with documented tetrachromacy that researchers aren't really sure. But this is an area of color research that's really picking up. And it was actually just in 2010 that they think they identified the first person with tetrachromacy or four-color vision.
So it's kind of like a superpower in a way. They can theoretically, it sounds like there's argument about this, but they might actually distinguish more gradations of color.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you looked at, say, a brick in a wall, and it looked like a flat gray brick to you, a person with tetrachromacy might see other shades of color in it, not just, you know, a flat gray, but they might see other shades of colors you can't see, and even maybe colors you can see but don't particularly see in that brick. So they're still figuring out, and there's still a lot of debate in research circles, like exactly what does it mean, exactly what are they seeing? Because, you know, if you can't see it, how do you know that the person's really seeing it, right? They're trying to figure out ways to measure it and really quantify it to be able to study it in, you know, a really scientific manner.
Gemma, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. That was Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us about once a month to share interesting science news. You know, I don't think I have any kind of color blindness, but I definitely have a more limited range of color detection ability than many people around me.
I would say that's true. Like, fact check, yes.
Is light blue? Are we in agreement on this?
That's light blue.
We argue at home about the colors of things.
I do with my husband more than one might
think. I suspect that I'm wrong,
actually.
Usually.
But I mean, I guess it just, you're both right, because it sounds like we're both seeing different versions of the same color.
What a lovely way to look at it.
Thank you.
Great leaders are made, not born. That's one of the lessons our next guest took from her study of five historical leaders who faced overwhelming challenges.
In her new book, she looks at the stories of Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, Ernest Shackleton, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and Rachel Carson. She says we can learn a lot by looking at the ways those leaders responded to the challenges they face and apply those lessons in the modern world.
Nancy Kane is a historian at Harvard Business School, and her new book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Nancy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to work with you folks.
You've got a diverse array of people in your book covered. Why are they all leaders? What makes someone a leader?
Well, that's a great question. And I use this definition in the book, which I think is broadly applicable and absolutely compelling. And it comes from David Foster Wallace, the American both prose and or nonfiction and fiction writer. And he wrote this in a Rolling Stones article that he authored many years ago. Real leaders, and I use the term courageous leaders, are individuals who help us overcome the limitations of our own laziness and weakness and selfishness and fears, and get us to do harder, better things than we can get ourselves to do on our own. And that definition, I think, captures the essential, if you will, or defining aspects of these five, as you point out, very diverse people. And they manage to do that, that is to, you know, motivate people to do harder, better, more important things than they can do on their own toward very powerful, right, very, you know, important and worthy ends in each case, from Shackleton getting his team home alive after, you know, almost 2 years stranded on a floating iceberg in 1916 near Antarctica, to Rachel Carson, you know, setting the world on fire and calling citizens to great awareness and action on behalf of the environment with the publication of Silent Spring in 1962, to Abraham Lincoln leading the nation through the Civil War and transforming it, along with Frederick Douglass, as he did. And so they made a big, good, worthy difference, and they did it by inciting others in keeping with David Foster Wallace's definition.
What I like about the definition you work with, and I think refer to throughout the book, is when we think of leader, often we might think of an elected official, a CEO, a general, that sort of thing. Right. By this standard, anybody on a different scale or another, anybody could step into that role of leadership.
Absolutely, Rob and Veronica. And I think that's really important because we're living in a time, right, when we need leaders from all walks of life, of all shapes and sizes, from, you know, school principals to firefighters to parents to community organizers to senators, generals, physicians, right, to step up, you know, into their stronger self and make a positive difference. The stakes are very, very high in many contexts right now.
And leaders, as we mentioned earlier, they are really made, not born. There's not some sort of inherent quality that's going to make one person a natural leader. They grow into it personally and through the challenges they face.
Exactly. And part of the, I mean, you know, I didn't write this book with that theory in mind and then set out to prove it. I just followed my nose for these fascinating stories. And what unites them, and there were several other people I could have put in the book, and for different reasons, they didn't, if you will, make the final five or the fantastic five, as my editor at Scribner says. But what struck me about these stories as I began to literally piece them together, because the story of Dietrich Bonhoeffer has never been told as a leader. The story of Rachel Carson has never been told from the frame of leadership. Even the story of Frederick Douglass hasn't been told that way. And nor is Shackleton's, in the sense of what lessons does his story have. Lincoln has, but I tried to find very hard new things to say about Abraham Lincoln. I think I've succeeded. My readers will let me know. But what was struck me in each of these cases was, as I'm putting the puzzle together, is how each of them met a series of crises, and none of them saw these calamities coming. None of them expected to be in the perfect storm with the high waves and the fast winds. And it's in those moments, in the crucible, as I say in the book in a couple of places, that they can't see exactly how to get out, how to get through, but they resolve to somehow, by hook or crook, navigate through the storm. And they also resolve, and this is what's so, I think, I hope, inspiring it was to me, they also each resolve in different ways, but unmistakably with themselves, to somehow in the cauldron of crisis, get better, find more access to their stronger self, develop their courage muscles, right? Climb onto the higher road if they can and when they can, and if they fall off, get back on. And that combination of being, you know, making that covenant, the resolving to navigate through, and then in the course of that getting better, right? That is the real, if you will, kind of most powerful of the threads, the many threads that connect these stories. And again, it's, I think, highly relevant to our moment, which in which we seem buffeted by crisis after crisis.
Talking to Nancy Kane about her new book, Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. We can't go through all of the five stories. We could spend hours on any one story, but I want to look at some of the lessons you draw. One quote that struck me from your book from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He's in Nazi Germany, young minister, sees the rise of Hitler, one of the first people to be worried about it. He leaves, he comes back knowing the risks, and he writes in 1939 about the risks of openly defying Hitler and the Nazis. Here's his quote. He notes how much personal concern, how much fear is contained in today's decision, as courageous as it may appear. So he says he knows from the outside it might look courageous, and he's overcoming this incredible internal fear to make this decision.
Certainly is, and God bless you for your careful read, Rob. So just for our listeners who don't know the story, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a minister, right, in an alternative church to the Reich Church, the Nazi Church, who had been fighting Hitler through that vehicle, in that channel, for 6 years. In 1939, he is such a suspect figure by the Gestapo and the SS that his friends get him to the United States for a year of safekeeping, where he's going to be arrested, possibly executed, held in a concentration camp, which others of his colleagues had been. And he gets to America, gets to New York, and he wanders around New York, and he's here for almost a week and a half, and he can't stand not being in the thick of it with what he calls his brethren in resistance. And he travels back to Germany after less than 2 weeks in New York, gets on the last ship out of New York for Germany before the Second World War breaks out in September of 1939, and begins life as a double agent, right, fighting the Germans as a member of the military intelligence for the Nazi Germany, but working really for the resistance in an attempt to assassinate Hitler and overthrow the Nazi government. And in that decision, he says, I was so frightened, right? And that's the interesting thing about each of these people. They ultimately are courageous, but they don't find their courage muscles before they literally, from Frederick Douglass to Lincoln to Carson, to Ernest Shackleton, to Bonhoeffer, step into the fear. And so the book is a reconstruction of their emotional experience. And I had to do a lot of digging through diaries and notes and intimate letters to read to do that. But it is ultimately about their all-too-human experience, being in the storm, being scared, taking a baby step into the fear, discovering some courage, taking another step, and just carrying on, right, in these big, worthy endeavors.
Another lesson, turning now to Abraham Lincoln. That kind of surprised me, actually. One of his turning points was when he realized in the face of turmoil, when he's having this incredible emotional response, one of the most important things he did was nothing, at least not right away. He learned to temper his immediate response and reflect on it and then talk about how he did that.
He did, and interestingly, all the leaders do in the book. It's one of the concluding lessons in the last chapter of the book. But this is so interesting. So the scene, right, if we lay the scene, as Shakespeare would say, the scene is July 1863. The Battle of Gettysburg has just concluded, right, July 1st through 3rd. The Union Army wins. It's led against it's led by a general named George Meade, who works for the federal government, and his troops were up against Robert E. Lee and his soldiers and his officers, and in the end, again by a hair's breadth, right, the Union Army wins the encounter, tremendously important, and Lee and his army of Northern Virginia stagger back, you know, wounded and you know, greatly depleted, and they stagger back to heading south for Virginia. And George Meade elects that third day, July 3rd, and the next day confirms this, that he's not going to follow them, that his soldiers, he believes, are simply too tired to brave another battle. And so he doesn't pursue Lee. Lee gets home safely, if in much smaller numbers than he started out. And Lincoln learns of this on the 5th of July by telegraph, and he's just absolutely livid. I mean, he's so hot under the collar. You know, he's just furious because he really believes that if Meade had attacked the Confederate Army then, as they limped home, the war would be over and the Union would have won and Lincoln would have saved the nation and ended slavery. And Lincoln starts to get work up ahead of steam, writing a letter to George Meade, more than 3 pages long, and starts off gracious and gets angrier and angrier. You've disappointed me. You have no idea of the untold deaths that will still result because you didn't end the war. And it goes on, like any of us writing a heated email in, again, when our temperature, our emotional temperature is high. And then I picture him, because I've spent so much time with Mr. Lincoln, I picture him standing back from his writing desk. He always wrote at this desk, standing up in a corner of one of the center rooms of the second floor of the White House, and taking a big breath and going, wait a minute, if I send this, George Meade, who I had only recently appointed as head of the Union Army, he'll get angry. He'll resign. I've already alienated a whole bunch of the brass from West Point because they don't want to fight the kind of war I want them to fight. And I've just struggled with all my generals. Can I afford to alienate another one? Do I have anybody in reserve? And he doesn't yet, in July of 1863, have Grant or Sherman, whom will become the really important leaders that trust Lincoln, that he trusts over the next 18 months, and that will really prosecute the war that Lincoln believes must be fought to end the war, end the conflict. And so he steps back, and he folds the letter up, and he puts it in an envelope, and he puts it in his desk, and it is found after he's assassinated, and it says, to George Meade, never signed, never sent. And I always say to my executives, these leaders I coach, and who I have tested all these chapters with, as well as my students at Harvard Business School and the Kennedy School at Harvard, I always say, imagine if Lincoln had email, and then just so bothered he can't stand it, so keen to do something, he had hit send. You know, the course of world history might have been different because he had no generals in reserve, and he had to have generals to fight. So the lesson there, and it's a really important lesson in our red-hot, our white-hot, reactive moment, is just step away, consider in the heat of the moment when you are all churned up, doing nothing. Sometimes nothing, I say in the conclusion, is the most powerful something a leader can do. Or to put it in modern email parlance, consider the advantages of the drafts folder, putting it in drafts. Because we all know we rarely make the good decisions in the heat of the moment. And sometimes, and we've seen this in our public stage today, very, very senior leaders, very powerful people can send stuff out in the heat of the moment that actually does damage.
Harvard historian Nancy Kane is with us talking about her new book, Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Who would you point to as an example of courageous leadership in a challenging situation? Is there a world leader, past or present, or someone less famous maybe that you've worked with who you take inspiration from? And what makes a good leader? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Nancy Kane is with us, sharing lessons from leaders who faced overwhelming challenges. Her new book is called Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a person, past or present, who you think of as an example of courageous leadership in a tough situation? What qualities do you think are most important in a leader, especially in tough times? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I want to peek in, Nancy, at a couple of the other leaders you profile in the book. Rachel Carson, as you say, she hasn't been written about in terms of a leadership before. Looking at her story, the book The Silent Spring, and her activism, what lesson should we take from her when it comes to leadership?
Well, there are many lessons. I certainly urge people to read this extraordinarily poignant, extraordinary gripping story of this woman trying to outrace metastasizing cancer while she finished what she knew would be a very powerful book. But I think, to me, the most important lesson is that a quiet, shy, unassuming, introverted person can be as authoritative and can have as much impact as the President of the United States. So we tend to think of leaders as, you know, necessarily charismatic or, you know, hard-driving or aggressive. She was none of those things. Her charisma came from her deep knowledge, her poetic language, her seriousness of purpose. But she was not charismatic in the way we usually apply that term, nor was she particularly aggressive. She was dedicated. She was serious. She was hardworking. But that's not usually the way we think of aggression. And she was certainly not hard-charging. She was careful. She was painstaking. She did her homework really well. And yet, her book, more than any other single thing, and she, more than any other single person, really helped launch the environmental movement. And that's just a huge contribution, and she did it as a quiet, extroverted person who very much preferred walking the shorelines of southern Maine to walking the halls of power in Washington. So leaders of all shapes and sizes, take heart, right? Take great heed. You, too, can make a tremendous difference, whether you're shy and retiring or charismatic and aggressive, as we think of those terms today.
And you've talked about charisma and that sort of aggressive leader profile, and in our political system and in many political systems, past and present, that kind of charisma has been what sways a crowd of voters or supporters. It doesn't necessarily make someone a good leader, though, you're right.
It does not. It does not, right? Leadership is, leadership is about, first, right, a fundamental commitment to a worthy mission, but as important, right, is one's character and the way one shapes that and chooses, right, to have that shape by their experience, by their encounters, by their own conversations with themselves, particularly in adversity. You know, I've been saying recently to people when they ask me what did I learn about modern politics from writing this book, I've said, we voters, we citizens, have to stop getting seduced by leadership bling, by things that aren't essential to really, you know, bringing the public good into practice and into reality. And those things are about character and public service, putting others first. They're about a big, worthy mission. And they're always, you know, we can always get at some of that by asking questions, not how much money did that person make, or not which celebrities that person spends time with. That's just bling. We need to know, you know, how did they respond when the going got really tough, when the dominoes fell against them? That tells us a lot about who they really are. And one's character is the most important factor, right, helping us understand what makes a good, much less a great leader.
Talking to Nancy Kane, her new book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Let's continue that talk about character and Frederick Douglass making this huge decision that he was going to devote his life to ending slavery, not just for himself personally, but slavery, period.
Frederick Douglass, you know, was just a fascinating case study for me because I didn't know very much about him. There aren't a huge number of biographies about him, even though he was without doubt the most famous African-American of the 19th century. And even though without doubt Lincoln could never have issued the Emancipation Proclamation as he did in the fall of 1862 and then prosecuted a war to end slavery. That's not the purpose the war started out with, right? That became the purpose of the war. As well as saving the Union after the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln could never have done that without the activism, organization, rhetoric, political connections, dedication of Frederick Douglass to changing political sentiments on the part of white Northerners. And he'd been doing that since the mid-1940s. So Frederick Douglass is an essential part of the story of how slavery ended, and Lincoln recognized that as such by the time, you know, the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery had been passed in January of 1865. He and Douglass, incidentally, came to like and respect each other, and they met several times. But Frederick Douglass is an escaped slave who educated himself, right, in very ingenious ways, escaped from slavery when he was 20, and then really brick by brick built a career, first as an abolitionist working with well-known white abolitionists like William Lloyd Garrison, and then on his own. Right? And he, like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, got spirited away to England because when he published his first autobiography in 1845, it got too hot for him with his owner that he'd escaped from wanting to capture him and send him back to slavery. And then he, like Bonhoeffer, decides after a couple of years of being a celebrity abolitionist in England that he's coming back because he has to be in America because that's where the real struggle is to end slavery. And then he does. He comes back and makes a huge difference, but not without lots of moments of feeling he failed, not without lots of moments of doubt, not without tremendous obstacles that he faced at lots of twists and turns of his journey.
Nancy, as we start to wrap up, as I look at your book, it looks like you're really hoping to inspire people who read it. What are you hoping them to inspire to be inspired to do?
I'm hoping that leaders, again, from all kinds of different places and with different kinds of purposes, can read these stories, take the lessons in the stories that matter to them, right? This is not a you know, kind of a tell-all book. It's a book of stories, and then it's like an offering. Take what you want, disregard the rest, make it your own, because the world has never needed you to be on, you know, in touch with your stronger self and willing to access your muscles of moral courage and make a positive difference in whatever that field is that you're passionate about more than it does right here and right now.
Are Americans ready to take up the challenge of courageous leadership?
History tells us they have done that on many occasions, but it begins, right? It begins with a leader inciting a small group of citizens. Right, in whatever field he or she is working. Margaret Mead once said, the famous anthropologist once said, never doubt the ability of a small group of concerned citizens to change the world. Indeed, nothing else ever has. So Godspeed, let's get to work.
Nancy, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Rob and Veronica, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate that.
We've been talking to Nancy Kane. She's a historian at Harvard Business School. We've been talking to her about her new book. It's called Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. You can still share a leader who's inspired you. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us a message on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And in her book, she tells the story of five leaders, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Ernest Shackleton, Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, and Rachel Carson, looking at how their leadership can inspire us today, how they met challenges in their own careers, overcame difficulties, and more. And again, you could share your most inspiring leader, famous or not, tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Looking for a good book? Well, it's fall. Things will finally start cooling down, and we're going to need something to read.
And to help us find some ideas, we have Daniel Golden from Boswell Books in Milwaukee joining us on the show tomorrow. And you can help us get off to a start right now.
Right. You can share your book recommendations right now. Something you've read lately that you're excited about, something you can't wait to read, something on your reading list. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us a message on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm in a good spot. I'm in a reading logjam now. I just finished a book, SPQR, like A History of Rome by Mary Read. But sitting there waiting for me, staring at me are two fiction books, too, that I've got to get to. I've got to pick which one I'm going to start next. Do you have a good stack of reading going?
I've got a couple things going from the library. Finally, I've been on the waiting list forever, literally, it feels like, to read Sherman Alexie's new memoir, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. I love his writing, and this is really searing, really personal. I love that. And I'm reading a lighter novel at the same time. It's called The People We Hate at the Wedding.
That sounds fun. That's
yeah,
more,
it's a lighter
more
read.
Alley.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to talk books and reading tomorrow. Share your current read or your reading list. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.